You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and as I said before, next, a SARS update, that mysterious new respiratory illness that, as of today, has infected nearly 3,000 people around the world, killed over 100. It's almost hard to keep track of the exact numbers because they change so quickly. The number of suspected cases is increasing here in the U.S., and there have no deaths so far in this country have been reported. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention receives hundreds of public inquiries a day about the disease, and it's actually distributing guidance pamphlets to travelers arriving from China, Singapore, and Vietnam. And this week, Congress approved a $16 million bill for SARS investigation, and President Bush has signed an authorization allowing suspected patients to be quarantined. Now joining me to talk about the illness is Dr. Edward Walsh. He is a professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Rochester School of Medicine in Rochester, New York. He's also an infectious disease consultant at Rochester General Hospital. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Walsh.
You're welcome.
So what do you think about this growing concern about SARS in the U.S.? Are we still at a stage of a possible pandemic, or do you think the spread is coming under control?
Well, the difficulty at this point is we're very early in the epidemic. I think people have to remember that the information that we have has really evolved over the last 6 weeks to a large extent. And although it seems to be at this point limited to various hotspots, as they're called, throughout the world, there are a few documented cases in the United States, very limited number, fortunately, at this time, and we're certainly doing everything possible to contain that.
There was news this morning about three public health workers in the U.S.
I haven't seen that report, but the CDC did today, in their MMWR publication, identify five individuals, all of whom had come back from the hot spots, Hong Kong and Singapore, who were documented with the new tests that have been developed as having the coronavirus infection and SARS.
Mm-hmm. Are we now certainly have identified the agent?
Well, it looks the number of reports has increased in both number and volume, as well as scientific credibility since the very first announcement, which was made by the CDC on the evening of the 24th of March, where they had isolated two coronavirus isolates from samples. And since then, there have been isolates now from Hong Kong, as well as from Germany and Toronto, and now again the CDC last night published more information on this as well. So from different sites, we're getting the same virus. The sequence, the genetic sequence of these viruses appears to be very uniform from the different sites where the data is available. And so it's becoming more credible that this is, in fact, the causative agent. It's still tentative, however, and several other viruses and organisms have on occasion been isolated as well from some of these patients.
Mm-hmm. And the prospect of a vaccine is not in the immediate future, is it?
Well, it would certainly, if it were in the immediate future, it would certainly be a record in terms of time for development. Most vaccines take on the order of a decade or so,
right.
And this would obviously be something that might need to be fast-tracked should the disease spread more widespread and generally.
What about a test kit for an immediate, detection?
Well, yeah, in terms of that's an important point, because at this stage, the clinical diagnosis is in large part helped by the history of a contact with ill patients with documented SARS or living in a hotspot country. And so the accuracy of diagnosis is reasonably high. But if the virus were to spread beyond the very limited epidemiologic parameters that it currently is under, which is in very isolated areas of the world as well as within healthcare workers, that it would be much more difficult to diagnose clinically. this virus looks like clinically any other viral respiratory infection, or many other, I should say, not mm-hmm. any, but many other viral respiratory infections. And so it would be difficult to make a specific diagnosis. And the development of a rapidly available and very accurate test will be critically important in really controlling this epidemic. And there have been great strides made, again, in remarkable time. They're first generation tests at this point, but they are moving ahead very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to be research tests for a bit, though.
Yeah.
They're not going to be, quote, FDA-approved tests that rapidly.
I see that you're a professor of pediatrics. I've seen reports in the media that said that kids seem to be more immune to getting this than
well,
adults.
Well, there are very few reports. If you look through what is currently published, and, out of the 2,800 or so suspected or probable SARS cases that are listed on the CDC website, for instance, from mm-hmm. the different countries, at this point, what's published is probably under 200 cases, the largest being 138 from Hong Kong, where we actually have published data that we can look at. In that published data, there are very few children that have been identified or pediatric cases that have been identified. Three from Toronto that were recently identified and discussed in one of the journal articles were not that ill. They did not develop X-ray evidence of pneumonia, according mm-hmm. to the publication, and recovered uneventfully. It's certainly something that we're going to need to see more information on. At this point, I don't know how many patients, for instance, in Guangdong province or in Hong Kong are actually children. It's the epidemic started within the healthcare community, in a sense, because the first patients were admitted to hospitals. Healthy adults who were nurses and doctors and medical technicians became infected, and these then could subsequently infect family members, which would obviously include children, because generally these healthcare workers are relatively young and do have young children. Information on the those illnesses within those families is really yet to be published in any great extent, and so I think we'll have to see what happens with children if they become infected.
All right, let's go to the phones to Raleigh, North Carolina. Azuka, is that correct?
Yes, sir. How you doing, sir?
Hi, go ahead.
Good show. My question is, are children with asthma at lower or higher risk of contracting this disease? And would medications such as Flovent and albuterol help prevention and cure, or perhaps as first aid medication?
Well, there's no information at all about that that we could speak to, although there would be no reason why anyone with asthma should be more susceptible to contracting the infection. At this point, it appears that the virus, if it's truly due to the coronavirus, is rather contagious, requiring close contact. Specifically, having asthma or not having asthma may not influence the ability to contract the infection. Mm. Now, with any respiratory virus, having a underlying pulmonary process makes the disease potentially worse. The use of the anti-asthma medications would be beneficial to treat asthma, whether or not somebody has an infection.
Mm. We keep hearing back and forth how contagious, how easy it is to pick this up. Do you now, is that the latest thinking? You need to have close contact? We heard people just breathing the same air, that kind of stuff.
The transmissibility that will drive the epidemiology of the infection is not fully developed at this point. Clearly, close contact is a mode of transmission. Most respiratory viruses are transmitted by this close contact, either through relatively large droplets that could be generated, say, by sneezing or coughing, perhaps, and as well as hand-to-hand contact or personal contact, mm-hmm. which will spread what we call fomites. These are fairly large particles. The aerosolization type of spread, which is most characteristic of influenza and tuberculosis, is also potentially involved with this, although the data is not clear. And then there have been further routes suggested that could potentially be an issue, and such as through fecal matter. The viral genome has been detected in a substantial number of stool samples that have been tested in both Hong Kong as well as from the German publication.
There was even some word about cockroaches.
Well, that's been in the I guess not that's been in the newspaper, and it's been on the various network news on the internet, but there hasn't been anything published yet on that. Mm. So the
put that rumor
the well, I'd keep it in that category at this point.
Yeah, it's a rumor at this point. All right, let's go to the phones to Peggy in Minneapolis. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. I won a free trip to Hawaii at the grocery store.
Hey, can we go?
Yeah, come on. And I'm leaving on Sunday, and I just wondered, would it be totally silly to wear a mask on the airplane? And if not, what kind of mask?
Well, I think at this point it probably would be silly to wear a mask on the airport on the airline for two reasons. One, you're going to be traveling from a very low probability infection site, the U.S., to another very low probability infection site, Hawaii. I think it would be fairly.
Off of the mainland, U.S. We don't want people thinking that Hawaii is not part of the U.S., but that's what you meant to say. Right?
Well, mainland U.S.
Right,
yes,
right,
off
okay.
of the mainland. Well, I'm just
saving you mail coming in.
Okay, thank you very much for that.
Okay.
The second reason, so I think that it would be not warranted based on that statistical odds. The second reason would be that I'm sure you would horrify your seat partner.
That's already an issue, so that's kind of why I'm calling.
Can masks, if these are viruses, which are tiny things, can masks protect you from getting a viral infection this way, doctor?
Yeah, they're called N95 masks. They have to do with the ability to take out certain particulate size. The masks are effective at preventing spread of small particle aerosols. Nothing's perfect. But the ones that are known as N95 are currently being recommended for care. It's worth pointing out that in the U.S., five cases were identified by CDC's tests as having the coronavirus infection and SARS. And these five patients were all hospitalized, and this was in March. And it's interesting to note that none of the healthcare workers who cared for these patients, and these were approximately a month ago, have become ill.
Hmm.
And it's thought that part of that may be because of long time implementation of very effective infection control measures in the United States hospitals, as directed by CDC from really at the start of the HIV epidemic. These were instituted, and perhaps they are effective at limiting these. Now, this is a small number of cases, but it is interesting that it's a different experience than was seen in Hong Kong and Guangdong, where there was a lot of spread within the hospital.
Well, good luck, Peggy, and have a good time.
Well, thank you. I'll be listening if I can when I'm there.
I hope so.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's take another call. These are good questions. Mike in New York, New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I have a speculative question. There was some early speculation that it wasn't only corona, but there might be a cofactor pathogen. I've never actually heard of any disease that required two simultaneous pathogens, but if that turned out to be the case, what implications would that have for the treatment and control and containment of the disease? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Well, there are actually diseases that on occasion require two independent cofactors that will produce, say, a more severe disease or make one disease much more severe. And an example is one form of hepatitis where two different viral entities gang up together on the liver and cause more severe disease. In the study of respiratory viruses, it is well recognized in children as well as in adults that during the winter, when we see a lot of other respiratory viruses, it's not at all uncommon to find two different viruses simultaneous in samples collected from patients. Whether these two viruses somehow together make the disease more severe has never been proven. In the SARS epidemic to date, there have been an occasional case found where there are two different viruses. From the Canadian study, they found metapneumovirus in 4 of 5 coronavirus-infected SARS patients. Mm-hmm. The actual role of the metapneumovirus is really speculative. In other centers, CDC, as well as Germany, evidence of metapneumovirus infection has not really been found at any great extent.
We're talking with Dr. Edward Walsh this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And taking lots of phone calls, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Robin in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Robin.
Hi, I'm not going to Hawaii, unfortunately. I'm going to Toronto. And I'm interested in the difference in response in between the public health response in Canada, where they've gone into the first quarantines in since 1940s, and the response in the United States, which is old. Look, and I just wondered whether you had some what you thought was responsible for it. Is it just the low incidence in the United States?
Toronto is one of the hot spots of this, is it not?
Well, I guess it would be considered a potential hotspot. Certainly not anywhere on the scale that we're seeing in the Far East. It should be pointed out we're looking at a little over 100 cases in Toronto, in the Toronto area. Almost all of it, or essentially all of it, seems to be limited to healthcare workers who've cared for infected individuals, all of whom the original cases had come from the Far East, traveled and brought the disease with them here, and then spread to the healthcare workers, and then there have been spread within the families of the healthcare workers. There does not appear to be, at this point, at least much publicized evidence that it is spread to the community. So the hospital response in Toronto has been very serious, and they have, to a certain extent, closed the hospitals to traffic. And other than patients and healthcare workers, and they're being monitored very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Walsh, we've run out of time. I've got to say goodbye and thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And we'll be in touch as we follow this. We'll continue to try to update this. I thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Edward Walsh is a professor of medicine and pediatrics at the University of Rochester School of Medicine. He's also an infectious disease consultant at Rochester General Hospital in New York. We're going to take another short break, switch gears, and come back with an update on the Columbia shuttle disaster investigation. We'll be joined by NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, who's been covering this issue. So stay with us. We'll be right back.